All right. So I'm Jim Settle, and I'm the vocalist for whatever we're about to call this band. How's that?
My name's Roger Dell Martin, and I'm looking forward to what this band is about to do.
Hey, this is Doug Thiem, and I'm part of this band, what we're about to do, too.
All right.
Can we come up with a name?
Yeah.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man being realistic.
As the story grows.
You got this, Travis. Make him wait for it. Boom.
Welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. My name is Trav, and I have the supreme honor to have most of Vengeance on the phone. I'm talking to Larry Farkas, Doug Thiem, Roger Dale Martin, and new vocalist Jim Settle. This is I guess you can't call it Vengeance, but that's how everybody identifies with you guys. But this is crazy. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This is nuts.
You're welcome.
Absolutely.
So, there's all kinds of stuff I want to talk to you guys about. Most of it is just because you guys were one of my first bands. You were back there with like Believer and Deliverance and I guess Tourniquet came in a little later and the Crucified and all that stuff. And I like that it's not completely just nostalgic, because you guys are actually kind of like getting back together and playing some shows and everything. And coincidentally enough, one of my dudes here from the East Coast has kind of taken over for the vocals for you guys. And this is kind of an amazing, strange coincidence that I've been in diners with Jim in 2000 when we were out playing together with our bands. And here we are, the dude's screaming Human Sacrifice and Warfare and all that kind of stuff. This is crazy. So who wants to take the lead and tell me what the hell is going on with you guys?
Well, I'll talk real quick. This is Roger Dale, and this whole thing started back early when Doug got a hold of us, and he said, look, there's a concert that's a benefit for Dale Huffman, and you guys want to do it. And he said, yes, we do. And then we didn't really have a vocalist at the time, and it was suggested from several sources that Jim Settle would be a great fit for the band. Right. And we basically got a hold of Jim, and we basically looked at Hand of Fire's video. I can't remember the name of it, but it's
Prophecy.
Prophecy.
Okay, Prophecy. And I was blown away. The sound quality, just the professionalism of the whole video, I was excited about. And right. And that's really what got it started. We did a rehearsal for the gig, and we ironed everything out, and we played the SoCal Metal Fest and got a great response. And so we're just taking it from where it actually began early this spring.
Well, you said the benefit was for who? I'm sorry, I don't know who the benefit's for.
Dale Huffman. He was a big radio guy, and he actually helped Vengeance back in the day. Tantrum of the Muse. He would promote all these bands, and he was just really big in the industry. And he came down with cancer, and he died recently last year. And oh, okay. So they wanted to throw a benefit for him.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to talk about the true motivation for the band. And really and truly, when I talked to Jim about things, he said, look, you guys, you affected a lot of people in the past in a very positive way. And he's telling me, look, you guys, everybody loves you guys. I love what you do, and even still today. And I want to continue doing this. Jim said, let's make this happen. Let's affect the lives again. And then I'm excited about that. You know, mm-hmm. you can put a band mm-hmm. together for whatever reason to play, but that's not what we did as Vengeance. What we did, we put a band together to minister. And when I hear Jim saying, let's minister again, I get excited. There's a reason, and if God's behind this project, which I think he is, it's okay. going to explode, and I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
What's going on in the background of somebody's...
Some heavy breathing going on there?
Sounds like someone's painting.
We're painting the picture for you, Trav.
Yeah, I see what you did. That's as funny as you get.
That's all I got.
Let's talk about Jim coming in and filling pretty big shoes vocally. I mean, we're going to jump all over the place because I want to go all the way back to the beginning of Vengeance, how it formed and everything. I don't know how lightly or hard I can tread around the Roger Martinez stuff. You know, everybody wants to know what's going on there, but I'll only ask what you guys are willing to talk about, so that's fine too. But let's start here with Jim. He's the current vocalist of what you guys are doing now. You don't want to recognize it as Vengeance, but Jim is the vocalist. So why don't you take us to being in the room playing songs that you've known for 30 years, but having somebody else as the vocalist?
Well, I think that when you think of Vengeance, his voice is Roger Martinez, the voice of Vengeance.
Right.
And it's hard shoes to fill for him because Roger was a dominant person, a very strong personality.
Mm-hmm.
And when we would go on stage, he would sing with authority, and when he would stop singing and in between songs, he would speak with even greater authority.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a man who was very learned. He understood his gospel. He understood the message he was preaching. He could back it up. And I would dare anybody at that time to try to argue with him. The guy was amazing. Mm-hmm. He was an amazing tool. And when we would go out there and we would play, we would play heavy and loud and in your face, and was very aggressive. We were crucifying people on the stage, and we were in your face about what we believed. It was a very dramatic scene. And then at that time, Roger's type of vocals was never heard of. You never heard
Tell me about it.
A vocalist like that. When we first were released, people were going, what the heck is that? That's not right. Mm-hmm. People were calling us
it's not right.
because of that, you know? And
right.
and we were coming in, and our whole motivation was to play in the secular market. We never wanted to be branded as a Christian thrash band. We wanted to be a thrash band that believed in God, and you're going to hear what our beliefs are. You can speak about your beliefs, or here's our beliefs. We don't care. We want to play in the same place with you and with your crowd and go head-to-head with you guys. And that's what we did, and that was our passion. And when we would play, we would win respect from a lot of people in the secular market, and that's where our target was, because we were authentic enough to get their interest and have them appreciate what we were doing. And so when you speak of Vengeance back in the day, Roger Martinez was a huge piece of that. The guy was amazing. He was an icon. He was almost a bigger-than-life figure. And he can go out there and back up what he was saying. So yeah. So to say that Jim has big shoes to fill, yeah, absolutely. That place as a fixture for a person to stand on the stage it demands respect for what he created in it.
Sure.
And wherever Roger is now in his life, it really doesn't matter. Back then, what he did was amazing. He changed lives and helped people
become better people. And whatever mm-hmm. he is and whatever he believes and whatever he feels now, it's kind of irrelevant because he already did that. And he can't yeah. undo that in that sense. So I'm glad to re-look at all of our achievements back then and kind of freshen up and go forward and let's see what we can move with the same vein and the same thought and the same process and the same motivation. Let's see what we can do 30 years removed. And so it's, gotcha. For me, it's a really interesting I'm very excited about the opportunity. This is something new and something challenging, and I don't want this to be second rate. I want this new project to be something that is head to head with anything we've ever done in the past. So,
right. Mm-hmm. The going back to when Vengeance got started, it was Roger Martinez's. He's the one who kicked it off, right?
No, not at all. Yeah. Okay,
not at all.
No, let me talk about that.
Please do.
Okay, you guys. When I first moved to California, it was 1984, and Martinez was doing this. He was doing a thing called Take Heed Ministry, and this was real early in 1984. Okay, mm-hmm. and he talked to me about. He had the idea for a thrash band, but nobody would mess with it. And I was like, no, I don't want to mess with this. And then it wasn't heard from Martinez at all. And what happened was Pastor Bob Beeman, he was discipling a young guy who was really into the scene. And it was kind of a new scene. Me and Doug were real close to Pastor Bob, okay? And he called us in his office one day and says, look, you guys, I have an idea, and I think you guys could do this and pull this off. Brand new thing. And so Doug and I agreed on it, and we went on the search for musicians. We stole Larry from Deliverance, quite frankly. Larry, he was super hardcore, and he weren't, and for some reason, for a big reason, I know he felt it. He joined Doug and I. And Doug and I, we went through a lot of different people. We haven't had mm-hmm. a lady singer one time. And we had some people. We went through a ton of people. Glenn Rogers was in the group for maybe 2 weeks. Okay, really? I want to tell. He was a great musician. He wrote the format for some songs. He really did, and he gets the credit for it. But we changed everything. In fact, when we first got the band, Glenn Rogers, his timing with his songs is very, very unique. And I remember trying to learn this stuff, and it was really bizarre to me because I'm old school. 4-4 timing and that kind of thing. And it was really, really difficult for me, but we pulled it off. And right. for whatever reason, Glenn left the group and he said, you guys can have the songs. And so we took the basic format of those songs. They were completely named different and everything. And we took that, Doug and I and Larry, and we put our own twist on it. And me, Doug, and Larry, we've always been from a blues, you know, flat five type.
Yes, format. I love that.
And anyway, we took that, and we got Glenn to play drums because he was on the worship team, and he said, "Okay, I'll do it temporarily." And all of a sudden, Martinez was the last one to enter the group because we were looking for people. And basically, we asked him to come check things out, and I knew before that he was interested in that. I just called Roger Martinez, and anyway, our first rehearsal, he basically barked into the microphone, and we all fell out, and it was perfect. There was 10 seconds into it, and everyone knew this is the band. Wow. And that's how it all started, quite frankly.
Okay, I was. Dead ass backwards wrong on that. He was the last one to join. I didn't even know that.
Yes, he was. And he was perfect. And he was last. He was the very last piece of the puzzle. And we needed. And he was perfect. Like Doug said, he was absolutely incredible with what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to tell you something else. You know, Doug was bragging on Martinez. He's very confident. And he controlled the stage. But... And you say Jim has he has big shoes to fill, but I'm telling you what, one of the main reasons of Martinez, he had confidence. because he had a badass band behind him. No kidding.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
We were flipping. We owned the stage, and he had that band behind him, and he with authority, and he knew it, and everybody, the whole crowd knew it. And see, Jim's got that foundation too now, mm-hmm. and so we're on right off the bat. He's on equal footing. Now, where it goes from that, I want it to excel that. But once again, we're the backbone, and we're here, for Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, look at that, Jim.
Right? I'm just so blown away, you know, just even these guys calling me up to even do vocals, you know what I mean? And, mm-hmm. But, you know, I knew I could step into those shoes because I have that confidence. I have, you know, a lot of backers with me, like Juan Tiaga and or my producer and Rottweiler, and so I knew I could step into the shoes. I didn't know how people would feel about it, but after we did that SoCal Metal Fest, everybody was like, wow, like this was the best I've ever seen Vengeance, you know. And these guys grew up with Vengeance, which I thought was really cool. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, so I, you know, gained a lot of confidence just from that show, you know, myself. And that's why I was pushing with these guys, because I really felt in the beginning that, hey, when these guys asked me to do this, I knew I could take this further. And I knew I could take, you know, Vengeance as it was and make it Vengeance as something today, mm-hmm. and move forward with that. And I think we're about to do that.
This reminds me, stick with me, bear with me a minute. This reminds me of Alice in Chains, because like Roger Martinez isn't dead from a heroin overdose like Layne Staley was, but Alice in Chains went, they're done because Layne's not around. And then they came back with Willem, and it was like, well, all right, I'll give him a chance. I'll take anything just to hear Alice in Chains again. I'm glad they're still around. And then a couple albums in, you're like, wow, what? Like, this isn't just, yeah, I'll settle for it because otherwise there's no Vengeance. I'll at least just take this dude, right?
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to hearing you, like, being able to take it next level, kind of.
Yeah. For sure.
You know what I mean? And Alice in Chains is the first thing that popped in my head. But I know, talk about big shoes to fill. When that guy was asked to be the lead singer, he must have been like, ugh. Like, the Layne comparisons are never going to stop. Are you a little concerned about it? Does that weigh on your mind at all?
No. At their SoCal Metal Fest, it was, you know, everybody already knew me kind of from Hand of Fire, you know, and...
Right.
And what I could do there, and I kind of changed up my voice for the Vengeance, and but I think it fits right along with it, and and in timing and everything else, I think so. And you can ask these guys; they might have something else to say. But I believe that, I believe that we could take this to the next level. I know we could take this to the next level. You know, and we've already picked up management. We picked up, you know, a record deal, and we picked up, you know, a bunch of stuff from it. So I know we can take it to the next deal, next level.
It goes to show, Roger Dale, goes to show that it still matters if all of a sudden all that kind of stuff is happening. That's important, man. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Travis, you know, we're talking, Vengeance is the foundation for this band, but we have come a long way since then. It's been 30 years, and there's lots of new musical input that we're going to put into this album. Quite frankly, I've been doing the contemporary Christian music for the last... I mean, I play every weekend. I play a gig every week, and I study this music every week. So where I'm going to come from is going to be crazy, because right now I have a contemporary Christian music thing, and they're the same chords. There's lots of different things going on, and I'm going to add this to the musical soup. Doug, he has ideas that it's been in his brain for years, and so does Larry. Okay, so he's very fresh. In fact, Larry and I talked about this morning because Doug's fresh, and it's just like Ted Nugent. He used to go off on a safari. and he wouldn't touch a guitar for a long time. He'd come back, and he said, man, all my licks are fresh. Everything's fresh.
That's interesting about the Ted Nugent Safari thing. That's something else, Doug. Do you have any?
But you want to hear something really crazy?
Sure.
The producer behind Ted Nugent is going to be the same producer behind this new project, which is Juan Urtiaga. So Juan Urtiaga produced Ted Nugent. So there you go.
Well, that's amazing, because really and truly, Ted Nugent back in the day, he ruled. Back in the 70s, in fact, the biggest concert I ever went to called Texas Jam. It was in 1978, and Van Halen, the biggest bands were there, and Ted Nugent ruled. Okay,
right.
And he ruled the stage, and we have something in common. When Vengeance took the stage, we'd rip your head off and do down your neck. Okay.
Whoa, language.
And Ted Nugent did the same thing. We had the same approach. And Jim, when you say Juan Urtiaga did stuff with him, I'm flipping excited about it.
Oh yeah, man. He produces Ted Nugent. So it's one of them things where, as I said, we have one of the biggest producers behind us, who is just ready and willing to do whatever we want. And so to me, I mean, that's a big deal. You know, if Juan wants to do it, I'm in, you know, and because I know he'll do a great job at it and, produce something of today.
Doug, do you have any comment on that?
Ted Nugent's one of my heroes. So, hey, I'm all for that.
Yeah?
He's probably one of my biggest influences, I think.
Yeah. I got to admit, I don't like Ted Nugent at all. But it's all good because I don't listen. And Travis knows. I don't listen to any of those old bands or anything like that. Led Zeppelin. I'm pathetic when it comes to music. But, you know.
Yeah, Jim. I know. Jim Settle likes songs. He doesn't like bands. He likes songs.
That's right. Dude, you remember that. That's exactly right. I like
songs.
I've
known you for 20 years, of course. We used to argue in diners about that, where you'd be like, yeah, I don't like Meshuggah, but they have that one song. And I'm like, how did you hear one song and not know it's from Meshuggah? They're not on like a car commercial or the radio or something. You're just a weirdo. I don't know how you navigate through metal.
Travis, here's the thing. Now, Ted Nugent, it wasn't necessarily his music that made him the king. It was his attitude. See, you have to go to his concert. He had the attitude. And you can listen to his music. You can hear some of the attitude, but it's in a live performance. Yeah. It was on. And just like a live performance that we had, I mean, it's on. And people could feel that. So that's the connection.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm not in love with the man right now. I have to admit. Musically speaking, I get that he's a complete juggernaut, and I hear him on the radio a lot. I get that. The guy can play the guitar. And I get it. That's cool. Is that where you're from, Roger? Texas?
No, I'm from Oklahoma.
Oklahoma?
The whole thing about Ted Nugent, it was just to illustrate the music's going to be fresh.
I know,
Doug,
I got you.
Doug's been, it's just going to be fresh. It's going to be new stuff with the foundation of Vengeance, which was the foundation of Robert Johnson and Muddy Waters, basically.
Right on. Now, what was that?
That was a motorcycle just started up.
Yeah.
Has anybody heard from Larry? Did he text anybody or anything?
No.
He just dropped off, huh?
Larry takes care of his brother, Elmer.
Mm-hmm.
He's about, I think, about 15 years older than Larry.
Okay.
Larry's lived with him most of his life. Elmer was in the military, and he became disabled from the waist down. And so he always kind of needed some kind of assistance care. But over the past 20 years, his health has really taken a beating, and Larry's been there as the anchor. And Larry's really, truly sacrificed his life. You know, you could talk about people with really good intentions, and people go, yeah, he's a great guy. Larry gave his life for his brother, literally, to take care of his brother. And, I mean, he literally gave up everything he had to make sure that his brother felt good. And that's the kind of guy that Larry is. Larry's amazing.
Right on. That's that is amazing. That's selfless. Selflessness.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Can I touch more on that, Travis?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Larry, like Doug said, he has given up his life, but Larry is one of the most talented men I've ever known.
Okay.
Okay. He was a big, he's just talented. When he's on stage, people are drawn to him. Everybody wants Larry to play in their bands. In fact, on SoCal Metal Fest, he was scheduled to play with two other bands. No kidding. They all want Larry to play. And see, he sacrificed that. No telling what Larry could have possibly done and with his music career. I'm not kidding. He could play for Ozzy very easily. Okay. But he's chosen to do what he's chosen to do. God's going to bless him for that. Believe me, I tell him all the time. I said, the Lord's going to bless you, Larry.
That's cool.
Because he has sacrificed that. But once again, Larry, he's a machine gun. Nobody can touch Larry on stage. Nobody in this whole world. And once again, he's put it on hold. And guess what? I'm excited about this new album because Larry's going to explode. Doug's going to explode. Jim's going to explode. And believe me, I'm a powder keg, too.
A little bit of history when you get back into the whole Vengeance Inception thing. Me and Larry grew up together. I've known him since 7th grade.
Okay.
And so we used to play in the garage together and just jammed for all of our childhood years. You know, my earliest memory of learning to play guitar is with Larry sitting in front of Pat Travers live and just playing all the riffs off of that. And Larry, from the time that he first picked up the guitar, was different than anybody else. Because I would sit there and play it, and I would get the feel for the riff and stuff, but Larry would learn every note for that solo and nail the tone and get it perfect. And he would pull it off. And then you go, you know. And he was in this little cover band for a while. And every single song that he played it better than I've seen the actual person who wrote it play alive. he is that way. He is very, very just a perfectionist when it comes to his playing. And
wow.
I mean, I've never seen anybody. I mean, he would play a song, Heaven and Hell, from Black Sabbath and the cover band. And oh my God, it was perfect. I mean, because I know that solo in my head. I know every little inflection. And he nails it every single time he would play. And this song going, he would get a standing ovation after that song every single time he'd play. Because people go, wow, that was amazing.
Wow. Yeah.
But that's who he is. The guy is just phenomenal. And when Roger says he could play with anybody, you know, he could play with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's truly that amazing. But he can't work a phone. Because
no,
the five of us not batting 1,000 with the Skype. I'll admit it. This show has its.
But it's all new, man. I like it. I like learning that new technology and mastering it, and then figuring out what it'll do for me.
We have not mastered it, Doug. We're definitely not there. But we know more than we did an hour ago, don't we? Right.
Well, we're all on, and well, most of us are on, and we're recording it, I think. So yeah,
I think Larry had to tap out. So oh well, that's okay. So going back to building off of what Roger was saying about how Vengeance got started, and y'all, I'm talking like him now, y'all from Oklahoma, stole Larry from Deliverance. and got Martinez, and then Vengeance started stomping around California doing its thing. I ask this of a lot of bands from back in that era. This was kind of a new thing. I mean, the Pastor Bob Beeman Sanctuary Church thing, that was kind of a launching pad for a lot of this stuff. But Vengeance seemed to be like the one of the byproducts of something as big and powerful as Sanctuary and Bob Beeman and that area and that era and that whole area and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, I wouldn't say we were a byproduct of that.
Okay.
Of all the bands, and you know, I've got to be quite frank with you on this. Doug and I and Larry, and we were all very, very much involved, but it wasn't a byproduct. We weren't one of the byproduct bands, and I'm not. See, when we came out, the whole Sanctuary embraced us, and I'll tell you, we had a huge ministry. There was ladies who would go to the, they had a bathroom ministry. We had this 1-800 number on the album, and the whole church was 24/7 taking these calls. It was a huge ministry. It wasn't like we were a byproduct. At one time, Sanctuary. At one time, I felt like Sanctuary was a support group for us.
Okay.
Once again, it was 24 hours on these. It was called the Crisis Line, Sanctuary Crisis Line, whatever. People call, people get saved. There's so much of the stuff that we did, Travis, that I had to put it aside. We had so many letters. See, we had secular distribution. We had European distribution that got a lot of attention. And I'm telling you, we got mail after mail after mail. And I had to, in a way, I had to phase it out of my brain and not focus on that or get the big head.
Mm-hmm.
But we were not a byproduct. We were one of the things that Sanctuary was called to do. And I believe that with all my heart.
Okay. All right. Okay. I was under the impression that you guys were all like in Sanctuary Church and Bob recommended Roger as a vocalist and it kind of all started from there.
No, not at all. See, there was a million bands in Sanctuary and we all loved the Lord and it was basically heavy metal bands, Neon Cross, Holy Soldier, we all attended. And then we had metal missionary meetings where Bob would set up these meetings and there'd be 100, 200 people there, all band members, it was all bands. But we were able to go forward with the thrash movement. And I've said this before, Orange County had the punk scene, L.A. had the metal scene, and sooner or later you got speed metal. And we had the perfect timing. We had the perfect vocals. The reason we took off, it was just perfect timing. Okay.
Gotcha.
Sanctuary had enough foundation at that time to really support us. Okay. And then once everybody jumped up, once everybody figured out we were of the Lord, because at first they were questioned it. Even Bob questioned it, like, what the heck have I got myself into? Okay. But it was perfect.
Right.
That's why we did what we did. We had support, and they were our support group. And that's how I feel about it anyway.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. I sit corrected. So you guys hit the ground running, and secular distribution, European distribution, you guys were not playing churches and youth groups. Like, when I got involved with this particular type of scene, I joined a band in 1999. So I was definitely on a paved road that Believer and Vengeance and the Crucified had put there for me. So thanks, by the way. But, like, you guys were pioneering something like this, to use a very, very large, throw around a big word that maybe I shouldn't do. But take us back to those shows. Take us back to, I always go back to Bruce from Living Sacrifice saying how they finally got a tour with Malevolent Creation and everybody was chucking them the finger and turning their back on them and ignoring them and everything. And that was four albums into their career. Three albums into their career. This was, you guys were like at the inception of this stuff. What was that like?
Well, I'll tell you what it was like, Travis. We would play. And when you said you play in churches, I'm like, yeah, right. We played some hellacious shows there in L.A. I remember one time. I mean, we played with just satanic bands, blatant. And I remember one time I wanted to throw up and almost threw up with the just the spiritual darkness of the place. And that's what we did. We had guys from Dark Angel. They respected us because we weren't wimps. We go up there. We would play. We'd play just as hard as anybody. And then we had Martinez. He was not a wimp, believe me. And he controlled the stage. And we preached. I mean, they preached Satan. We preached the Lord, and we were just as powerful, if not powerful. We made a lot of friends. Now, there were some places that we played that you could call a church. If you called New World Order, we played some hardcore places. Then they called themselves a church, but they weren't the church in the traditional sense at all. Mm-hmm. We jumped right into it in our ministry and giving our tapes out. We didn't go to the local churches. Here's our demo tape. We went to Slayer concerts. We were there. We were down in Long Beach. Long Beach is hardcore. People view Long Beach as, oh, this is wonderful. I mean, it was nasty, okay? Mm-hmm. You go down there, you better have your game face on. You get your rear end kicked, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. You know, we weren't playing, and we were real people. We just stood up for the Lord, and it buried. I was high testosterone way, quite frankly. And so for us to be playing the churches, not really.
Right, Doug.
Yeah, when we first started in the scene, that there is a club down in San Pedro, California, that was the Waters Club. And when we went down there, that area of San Pedro was just nasty, but gang, there was, you know, shootings and stuff outside the club all the time. And I remember going to our show. I actually brought my girlfriend's parents to the show. They wanted to see me. He was a principal of a high school, and he brought them down, and they went to the bathroom, and there was two girls in a fight and blood all over the place and knives. It was terrible. It was the worst of places to go, and that's where we thrived. And we went down there, and we pulled people into these clubs. And when we'd play the Waters Club, it was packed because that whole area was thrash music. The Wilmington, San Pedro, that whole Inland Bay Area. It was hardened metal thrash type scene, and we came right in the middle of that whole scene, and that's where we did our biggest. That's where we started the whole vision for this thing, because this was not a Christian. We weren't playing in a church and opened the church up and played to a bunch of Christian kids. There was maybe a dozen Christian kids there, and the rest were all just secular kids, and that's where we thrived. And did the best, because that's what we were called to do, you know.
Okay.
So when you talk about that, look, Roger touched on the punk scene in Orange County in Santa Ana. There was a big punk scene, and we paired up with the Crucified for
right on
probably about four or five shows we would do down in that area, and we paired so well together. Mm-hmm. Because it was half skinheads, half metal guys, and there were some serious pits going on at that place.
Right.
And nobody liked each other, and it was. And Biker James group was there to help keep the peace. You know, a bunch of bikers trying to break up fights and stuff. So it wasn't a traditional Christian crowd by any means. Huh?
No, I get that. Jim, is that you with all the noise?
I just stepped out of my car. I was like sweating to death.
Get back in your car.
I am. Jeez.
I don't care if you're sweaty. You're the one that chose to live in California.
I know. I know. It is hot. But it feels good. All right.
Travis, we could tell so many stories about that. I'd go on forever. But like Doug said, we used to pair up with Crucified, and there would be three groups at this concert. There'd be the skinheads, there'd be punks, and there'd be the long hairs. And like Doug said, they all hated each other, okay? Wow. And we ministered, we did what we did. I tell you what, when Doug's talking about the violence that was going on, I see just trash cans busted overheads, you know?
Yeah.
And then I see sanctuary people picking up the trash. We left the Waters Club at one time, and, you know, Sanctuary had all these spiritual gifts, and they had these people with the gift of mercy. They come up to me and go, Roger, there's a guy beat to shreds out here. What are we going to do about it? And I went over there, and I'm going, good Lord, help us, you know. at one show, you know, we have people get up to the front, and they watch the band. I was like, oh crap, here's these skinheads. They all locked arms, about 20 of them. They started rushing toward the stage and just smashed everybody at the front of the stage. And I'm like going, oh man. But, yeah, no. To say, let me just, we were not playing churches.
Yeah, again. How did you find your way out into this scene from Oklahoma? What brought you out to Cali?
That was a God thing. I've been a struggling musician all my life. I watched the Beatles on Ed Sullivan Show when they came out. Okay, and so I want to play in a band. I played in when I was 12 years old. I played in a band in high school. I played in a band after high school, and I could not succeed because I was in Oklahoma. I was a hick from the sticks, and still am, quite frankly.
Gotcha.
I'd worked with a construction company that went to different areas. I worked in Shreveport. I had a band in Shreveport. I worked in Mississippi. I was in a band in Mississippi. I worked in Arkansas, okay? And mm-hmm. then all of a sudden they said, oh, we're going to California, to L.A. Do you want to go? And I said, heck yeah, I'm going. And as soon as I went out there, first thing I did, I went to a music store. I said, hey, who's looking for a band? And the guy said, that guy right over there. And it was having to be Dave Enos and this glam band. And we were in a music store. He said, hey, do you pick up a bass? And I picked it up. And he started playing Crazy Train by Ozzy. I knew that song note for note.
Right.
And he was like, dude, do you have any bad habits? And I'm like, what the heck are you talking about? Anyway, he said, I want you to go over here to the fellowship. And he was a Christian. And that's how I get and I gave my life to the Lord. And I played in this glam metal band, Emerald, and I played in Holy Rot. And next thing you know, I'm in Sanctuary. And I met Doug. Doug and I hit it off big time because we're big Johnny Winter fans.
Okay.
And basically, that's how I got to California. God actually pulled me out there, and he had mercy on me because I was trying to make it in music. And he said, okay, but you're going to make it in my honor, Roger. And I said, heck yeah, let's do it. And the Lord
pulled
me out there.
Jim, if you don't get back in your car, I'm going to come out to California and kick your narrow ass.
All right, hold on. Here you go.
How many motorcycles are there out there on just the street that you're on?
Well, you know, in California, everybody rides motorcycles, except for me. Yeah.
Cool story. Get in your car. Another thing you guys have been up to lately is there's been a reissue of Human Sacrifice.
Yep. Yeah, they reissued it. It was the 30-year anniversary reissue.
There we go. So walk us through the inception of, like, take us back in the studio of 30 years ago doing Human Sacrifice.
There you go.
Okay, let me take you to the first thing we did, the demo tape. The performances on the demo tape were outstanding. If you listen to the album version of Human Sacrifice, mm-hmm. and then you listen to the demo tape, it's Martinez is so on. He was so on that day. Listen to it, and you go, good Lord. That was amazing. And see, he did the screams at the end of Beheaded, that just reflected. That was just the greatest day for Martinez, his best vocal day ever. And the guys in the studio for the actual album with the record company, they stole the screams from Beheaded and put it on there. But once again, that 30th release was a whole lot about the demo tape. Okay, and I listened to Human Sacrifice the other day, and I go, dang, Martinez was on. That's. Once again, Travis, the 30th anniversary was a whole lot about here's the demo, folks. Check it out.
Right. I remember hearing that for the first time. That was a hard sell for my mom, because she was like, you can listen to all the Christian music you want. And I was like, sucker, all right. So she thought I was going to be listening to, like, Petra, you know, which I did a little. But that was a hard sell for my mom when I had to when I had some of these albums playing in my room. You know, you had that big old boombox double cassette deck thing. And I would have Human Sacrifice and Beheaded going, and a Believer album or a Tourniquet record. And my mom was like, "What is this kid getting into?" And the screams at the end of Beheaded were merciless. They were tough. How far in? Again, this isn't live, so I'll edit around this and everything. How far into the Roger Martinez stuff? The disaster at the end of it. How far into the Roger Martinez stuff are we allowed to go?
However you want to go. It doesn't bother me to talk about it.
Okay. All right. So this is probably the closest I'm ever going to get to this conversation. So I remember ordering a Vengeance T-shirt when I was a kid, and because of that, I must have been on a mailing list or something like that. And I received some letters from Mr. Martinez. I'm sure you guys know about him. I'm sure you saw him. Kind of smashing everybody, saying how he was robbed, saying how, you know, blah, 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 blah. I don't want to drag the man through the mud. He's entitled to his opinion or whatever. But what happened?
In summary, at the end of this, the second tour, the Once Dead tour, things took, it ended bitterly between us. We had a lot of issues and stuff on that last tour. And there was a lot of separation between us and Martinez. And so at the end, I didn't feel comfortable carrying on doing any more work with Roger as it was. And I talked to the rest of the band, and they were pretty much in agreement. We're like, you know, we need to just shut this thing down. The way it's going now, it's not how it started out, and we didn't like the direction it was going to start to get into. And so
can you get into that a little? What happened?
You can get into it as much as it. We just kind of got out. We would tour, and Roger Martinez was no longer touring with us. We would be driving down the road, and he would fly in somewhere. He would take off with somebody after the show, and we wouldn't see him until the sound check or right before we're supposed to go on.
Really?
And so the disconnect, he didn't want to tour with us. We were disgusting pigs to him, and we probably were, but that's the way it is on the road.
Doug, why were you disgusting dirty pigs to your vocalist? Like, what happened that all of a sudden he was like a totally separate thing?
We as a group, me, Roger, Larry, Glenn not so much, but me, Roger, and Larry, we were a tight-knit bunch, right?
Okay.
And as young men going around, traveling down the road, you're going to fart and be gross and be everything like that, because that's what guys are, you know, at least we were. Okay, sure. Martinez was not one of those kind of guys. Martinez was above that, and we were kind of just disgusting little lowlifes to him, in a sense. Like, how dare you be that disgusting? And he didn't like driving in the van with us. Did not like.
Oh, so this, okay, wow, you're really talking like, this isn't disgusting, like all of a sudden you weren't spiritually lining up with him or aligning, or you guys had some huge theological thing. You're all of a sudden, he was just too good to be in the car with you.
Yeah, we disgusted him too much, and he was repulsed by us. And he found out that people would, Martinez, if you ever spoke with him, he was brilliant at manipulating you to get you to do what he wanted.
Okay.
He masterminded that kind of stuff. He could walk into a room and get people to start getting them water, get a table set up. Everybody would start doing things for him because he had a way of talking to you that made you feel compelled to do something for him.
Okay.
And it's brilliant. I admire that. I wish I could do that, but he did it. And he found out that, you know something, if I just push that gamut, I can get people to drive me to different places. And I could take a train, or I could actually fly over to here. I can. So he used that space in between shows and just took it and ran with it. And so towards the end of the tour, me and Roger ran all the finances for the whole band, right? We had to pay everybody their paychecks and do everything else and do all the things and all that kind of work, right? And Roger would show up for his check, grab it, and then take off, and we would see him maybe before one of the shows or something like that.
Wow.
And I was bent. I was like, you know, we're expending all of our energies here and trying to make this thing work. Right. And he's just out doing his own thing and doesn't really care, and he's not really participating, and I didn't feel like a band. I felt like I was working for him after a while. It was like, I was going, you know, I don't need this.
Okay.
And it wasn't going in the direction I wanted to go. And there was also a change at that point, because when we first started talking about secular shows, that's what our purpose was. And our driven goal was to play in clubs and to play with secular bands. And when we were signed with Medusa, that's what it was. And we were in secular distribution, and that's all it was. When we wound up getting bought out by Intense and getting spun over to Frontline, we got lumped into the Christian scene. All of a sudden, our next tour became churches and little clubs and that kind of thing with Christian things. And every now and then, you would have some decent shows worked in that were secular shows. But it started to fall apart in that way on the second tour. On the second tour, we weren't doing all hardcore metal shows, and we weren't doing that. I remember playing at a church and had a beautiful ferns and stuff all in the back, around the whole back of the thing, and they put us up on the worship stage, you know? And as soon as we came out, Drew Fisher took the torches and made the explosions go off, because that's the way we did things, you know? And he melted all the ferns. Every single fern shriveled up instantly in the back of the stage. And it's like, we weren't designed for that. This is not our calling. You know, we didn't even fit. It just didn't work. And then when you put all the internal band strifes going back and forth and trying to babysit everybody and manage the band, it just, the fun was gone. The vision wasn't there. And I was getting ready to pull out of this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Everybody else, except for Martinez, wanted to make a change, do something different.
Okay.
And when it came between us and Martinez, it was very divisive. And it was us four on one side and him on the other. And so at that point, we go, look it. Vengeance was a successful machine if you worked it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, me and Roger did all the finances. We know that we can make a tour work. We came out of that tour.
When you say you and Roger, you mean Roger Dale.
Roger Dale, yeah.
Okay.
And so we did all the finances. We knew what we had. At the end of the tour, we came back behind, but we also came back with a plethora of merchandise. So we had T-shirts and all kinds of stuff. We had just a lot of money loaded into this big old trailer, and we had this tribal trailer that we had that Martinez really wanted to buy for that whatever reason, right? And so there was a lot of capital money sitting there. We're going, look, we could dissolve the band and pay off everything and probably still walk away with a little bit of money in our pockets. Martinez wanted to have nothing to do with that. He wanted to run Vengeance and keep it going. And so at that point, that's where we made the divisive split. And we said, look, if you want to go on with Vengeance, go right ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Take all the merchandise, take the travel trailer, take everything you have here. You take the name, run with it. Have it, but it's yours. But we're not bound to anything else. Vengeance now, if you want to take it over, it's yours at this point.
Okay.
Roger Martinez did not manage itself well. On his next tour, he always wanted extravagant things for the stages and stuff like that. And I would imagine, I don't know what he wound up doing that caused him to lose money, but mm-hmm. I think he probably carried around a lot of useless crap to try to put on the stage and try to make it work the way he wanted, this really dark image and stuff out there. And it probably didn't work, and he went belly up, and then he blamed us for it. And there goes the letters, and we abandoned him and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But he was never left with a bag of debt, and we just screwed him. We decided, and he agreed, to take that. and take all of the opportunity to make more money that he could do, because it was a money machine if you worked it right.
Okay, so I've always said I'm not a zinger kind of a guy. I'm not looking for like the, you know, okay, ooh, the breaking news or whatever. But you're telling me right here and right now, all those letters he sent out saying that all the equipment was stolen and everything, total bullshit.
Stolen equipment?
Yeah.
I don't know about stealing equipment.
There's letters in there, and I don't have these letters in front of me because I haven't seen them in forever. And I have so many guests promising that they're going to send them to me, and I keep not getting copies of them. Mark Garza and Darren Johnson. But anyway, there was like photocopied receipts of like how basically like Die Happy took the equipment or something like that. Something along that lines. And I just remember reading it as a kid and being like, wow, I don't know what's going on here, but wow, it looks like he makes some valid points, you know? If that's not the case, then I just want the air cleared. I'm not looking.
What kind of equipment is this he's talking about?
Dude, I don't know. I don't have them in front of me, and I'm probably speaking out of.
I mean, we didn't travel with a PA or anything, so we didn't have like a band PA. We may have had monitors or something, right, Raj? But that would be Martinez's stuff. I don't recall any of that stuff.
I just remember we all had our photocopied own receipts and stuff, and I just remember being a kid and being like, well, he's got receipts. I guess it's legit. You know,
no, we all had our own gear, and we had our own thing that we bought with our own money, and everybody was responsible for their own thing. So, I mean, okay. Larry had his stack. I had my stack. Roger had his stack.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know what gear he's talking about. Anything that we had, we left with him that wasn't our immediate own possessions, you know. So, but I don't remember. And there was no equipment that we took from him, or I've never heard that part of the whole thing.
Okay.
I just heard that we left him with a whole bunch of debt, and we were mean and nasty people, and we refused to pay him.
Okay. All right.
Travis, let me throw my thing in here just sure. At the very end. People ask me about what about Martinez, what about this and that, and guess what? I've never told anybody about my personal feelings about things, and I never will, okay, because God knows what happened, and I'll leave it at that. But people okay. Forget about this. See, we had this big meeting at my house, okay, and we wanted, like Doug said, we wanted to disband it, okay. Just when it comes down to it, we're gonna do another concert, we're gonna sell everything, and we're gonna pay everybody off, which what Doug said, we had plenty of merchandise. It could have been easily done. He says, no, we're not gonna do this. Martinez argued with us, and this was at my house. It's just like it was yesterday, okay? And then mm-hmm. We go, okay, we finally gave in. Okay, you can have it. You can have it all. And I made and everybody said, okay, great. And he was so happy. And I made this agreement, okay, and I wrote it all down. Basically, the agreement said, I, Roger Martinez, take responsibility for all the debts, past, present, and future, of Vengeance Rising. He signed it. We all signed it. You know, people say, well, he bought the name from you guys. No, he didn't buy the name. All it was an agreement that he signed saying, I take responsibility for all the debts. He was super happy. We were happy. We were okay with it. Right after that, Heaven's Metal magazine, Doug Van Pelt, he did a big article on it about the breakup. He interviewed each and every one of us. And we were all, this is what happened, you know, and Martinez was the happiest camper on earth. He finally had control of the bands, and he was happy. And see, everybody forgets about that article. Everybody forgets about it. It was well documented. I can't even remember what edition it is. I don't care. But see, then all of a sudden, after he flips out, everybody's like, "What happened to Martinez? And did you guys really rip him off?" I'm saying, "Come on, now, it's all in print." And that sort of flips me out. Okay. And as far as what happened to him personally, you know what? That's between him and God. And I have my ideas, and I've never told anybody, and I never will, okay? But
okay.
If you're talking about the breakup, if you're talking about how did we rip him off, we did not rip him off at all.
Okay.
Okay. In fact, he wanted to do it, have it his way, and we're going, okay, have it your way, have everything. Here you go.
And there's something that Larry would always bring up, and it was, to me, always a really valid point. At that time, like Roger's wife, Carol, at the time, and Ruby, who was Roger Martinez's wife, they were part of this thing. They helped out and did a lot of work here and there and stuff like that. Ruby, his wife, still loves us and supports us and likes us. And if we would have stolen a bunch of money from Ruby, I think Ruby would have hated us, right?
That makes sense.
If we did something
sense.
So bad to her that she would have, you know, hated us. She doesn't blame us at all. She left Roger later on and stuff like that. And it's like, it's just like what Roger said. We ended in a mutual satisfaction type thing. And when it broke up and it dissolved, Roger walked out of that room happy. And like Martin said, he finally had the control to do what he wanted. He was always arguing what he wanted something. He wanted this, and we'd have to do a debate and a band vote and all kinds of stuff. And we were arguing back and forth about what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it. And it was always a push and pull between us. And now he finally had full control over it, and it was up to him to do what he wanted to do with it. So to me, it was always ironic that this whole thing came up like, oh, we stole from him. It's like, come on, are you serious?
Hey, man.
And then in the end, when Die Cat Happy came around, we still had 3 albums left on our deal with Frontline, right?
Right.
And at the end, on the second album, I wrote a bunch of the material that got the charting stuff on there. So I remember the guy came up to me, whoever it was, who wanted to sign and stuff. He goes, hey, Doug, are you guys going to do anything else? And I was going, no, I don't know. We're talking about doing this and that and blah, blah, blah. I go, but I don't know. And he goes, well, you know something? Let's sign you up and let's try to get a band together. I go, well, if I had something and I knew I could pay everybody to go into a studio and do all this, I think we could probably put something together. He goes, okay. So he signed me to a deal for Die Happy. So Die Happy came off because they still wanted to keep something going. And so
Who signed you?
Name.
Okay.
Do you remember who it was, Raj?
Say that again.
Do you remember who it was from Frontline who approached me early on and tried to get us to do the Die Happy stuff?
It was Duffy. One of Jim Kempner's homies.
Duffy. Something Duffy.
Okay.
But, oh, well. But Die Happy even started out just as a project. In the sense that we didn't have... I had a bunch of songs and stuff I wanted to work, and all the guys still wanted to play. And it's like, oh, cool, let's try something else. We didn't have a singer in place, and we didn't have any... But it's like, we loved playing with each other, and we loved being together and just doing this stuff. So it's like, it worked out so well. And so for us, the transition was very happy. It was like, oh, good, I'm glad Martinez is doing his thing. We're going to do this. We're going to kind of switch gears a little bit, kind of get more into more of our a groove thing and do this other stuff and get a different, an actual singing. Let's see what it's like to have a real singing. You know, for us, it was experimentation and fun, you know?
Right.
And originally, we were supposed to have Mike Lee sing, and then things fell apart with us.
No way!
Yeah. He was going to be the vocalist, and... But it just at the end, it just didn't work out and all that kind of garbage. But I would love to have heard what it sounded like with Mike Lee's vocals on there. You know?
Right on. How did you come up with the name and the kind of tongue in cheek silly logo for Die Happy?
I think we were in Florida or something, and some guy walked into our show and he had a shirt that said Die Happy on it. And I go, okay. I love that. And it just stuck. I go, I love that.
It's a very Forrest awesome. Gump, very Forrest Gump style story.
Like, very creative, Doug.
He didn't have a logo or anything. It just said Die Happy. I go, oh, that's hysterical. I think we all want to do that, you know. So I think when it came in and we had to make a name of band, Die Happy was just, like you said, it's very tongue in cheek. But that's how we are, you know.
Right, right on.
As a group, I'm getting we're very, you know, sarcastic and lighthearted.
Thanks.
Right, Travis.
Yes.
Here's another myth I want to dispel.
People
think that some people, or I don't know, they're like, yeah, you guys screwed Martinez and you started another band, Die Happy. No, that's not what happened. Die Happy, it started way later. I don't know how many months later, but whenever it was, we put this thing together, and we had people interested. Like, say, Mike Lee was going to be the singer, and believe me, it was about ready to go down. But that's another thing that I'm not going to ever tell anybody about that situation. That's the first time probably anybody's even mentioned that. Okay. But what I'm saying is it was a complete differently thing. We didn't have any idea we were going to do anything else. And at the time, we said, screw it. We're going to make a career out of whatever, you know. We were basically done with music. Not necessarily, but I was done with Vengeance. You know, right. I didn't think I'd ever work with these guys again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you see what I'm saying?
I do.
Not like we didn't screw him and take it. We didn't do that. It came about weeks and weeks, maybe months later, with the whole idea. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was Doug. He's the brains of all this. And he said, look, sure. A couple months later, whatever, he said, we still got a record deal here. And I'm like going, well, let's. And then all of a sudden, boom, and people were interested. And we ended up with Robin singing. And it was perfect. And that's what it was. And so, once again, that's a myth. That came about a lot after this breakup.
How did you happen upon Robin to get involved with it?
He was a Sanctuary dude that was playing in another band, and it was just Paul Rogers Incorporated, you know, and he was just a great singer, had a great stage presence, and basically we called him up. I think Doug called him up. We knew
and Glenn. It was one of Glenn's friends from St. James era days.
Okay.
Glenn the drummer, he knew so many people from the early metal scene.
Mm-hmm.
And just knew all these different people, and so and he played with what was Josh Pariah's old band? Was it Joshua?
I can't remember.
Did he play with Joshua?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he was the singer for Joshua at one time.
We are there as we are.
So Glenn knew of him. I never heard him from day one. Glenn goes. Glenn always knew that I loved Ian Gillan. I had affinity for Ian Gillan, favorite singer in the whole world, right?
Oh, right on.
And he goes, "Oh, I know a guy who can do Ian Gillan." I go, "Dude, if you know a guy who knows Ian Gillan, I go bring him in right now." And so we had Renaissance as the first startups thing, and so I rewrote the whole song because, like I said, it was going to be different singers through this whole thing.
Right.
And so we brought Robin in, and I go, here, try to sing this. And I just threw this thing as a swag at him. Like, oh, you want to sing? Let's see if you can do a Renaissance. And oh, my God. He started singing, and I was floored. I was going, what the? And so if you hear that, the first Die Happy album, and you feel like, well, he screams too much, and he's kind of repetitive, or that's my fault. Because I was so giddy. I was a kid in a candy shop. And all of a sudden, here's all these songs, and I rewrote everything just for his vocals.
I see. Okay.
I was going, oh, my God, I can exploit this. And I just made him go all over the place, right? And Robin probably would never have wanted to do half of that stuff, right? And I was just pushing, going, dude, try this. And
right.
He was doing everything. He, just amazing singer. Just amazing. So, a lot of people, I think, they heard that first time, they go, no, I don't like those guys who just scream and stuff all the time. I said, well, that's my fault.
Right. whatever. Roger, going back to what you said that's another thing that I'll never talk about. I want to get clarification on that. Do you mean why Mike Lee didn't get involved?
Mike Lee was very involved, and like Doug said, it didn't work out, and that's all I got to say about that.
Oh, okay. That's what I wanted clarity on. Okay, all right, that's fine. I have the. I don't have a hard copy of Die Happy 2, but I know I have the. I have a CD of the Intense Live series with Die Happy on it. That's pretty awesome. What do you guys What do you guys remember about that? I'm fascinated with this Intense Live series.
Well, with Roger, like I said, I kind of approached the guys to try to put Die Happy together.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody came together and we did it. At that point, I think Roger was kind of spent on the whole band thing and kind of wanted to just, you know, focus on work and do his own thing. And okay. So we wound up getting another one of Glenn's friends, his name was Greg Chason, to fill in for Roger. And Greg Chason, you know, Badlands bass player, and came from a different kind of cut of cloth from us.
Okay.
The guy was amazing, just truly amazing, just very professional, could play anything, just really, really awesome guy. But he came from a different genre or era from me.
Mm-hmm.
And when they came in and we started doing the second Die Happy album, Robin was now the returning singer. So he wasn't like the guest singer, and I was writing everything for him. And now it's like, here, Robin, write this. And we started working together, and here's, you know, Greg started writing, and we all started working together, writing this whole thing as a cumulative thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a different direction. It went way more kind of mainstream, bluesy rock, more straightforward rock type stuff.
Right.
And so when it came to the live and studio thing, this was like our second album without Roger Day on it, and it was kind of different in the sense that the live series, we wanted to do something that would be different. I didn't want to just play the songs live. I go, that's ridiculous. I go, let's make it acoustic. Let's try something different.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of took a couple songs, covered the Petra song, and kind of reworked some stuff and wrote a new song for it too. And I
forgot you covered I forgot you covered Petra on that, actually.
Yeah, All Over Me, or
I don't remember what it's called. I just remember it now. Oh my god, this
Robin
is...
was yeah, he could pull those vocals off. And, right. and so that when we got into the live thing, it was kind of fun because it really, I mean, if you listen to Vengeance on the first album and Die Happy as the live thing, this is a totally different band and feel and everything else. This is bluesy rock stuff going on here, you know?
Yep.
And so we fell more into our groove, and Glenn owns that kind of genre. Glenn as a drummer just can really play that 70s type vibe, you know? He's John Bonham Jr. or Ian Pace, you know? That's right. The way Glenn is.
Yeah.
So as soon as we started slowing it down and pulling it into that type of thing, he kind of locked in. And that live album was, I like the live album actually better than the second studio album.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was more fun and free and less structured. It was a little more free flowing and stuff. I kind of like that one.
That's why I'm asking about it. It just had a unique vibe that no Vengeance with you guys on it and no other Die Happy stuff had, that something about that something about that intense live release was just really inside the studio with you guys, you know?
Yeah, and that was fun. It was fun to play that because it was live. We just went in and mm-hmm. we wrote one new song for that. And so we just did all acoustic and stuff like that, and it was really cool. It was fun to play.
After all the tears have fallen, she burns a candle in the silence. Though her spirit cries, she cannot speak a word. Time goes on and on. And when the night falls down, she sings this song. Fly me away to the temple of your soul. Lay my body down to rest.
I have the utmost respect for Roger Martinez. The guy was a brilliant man. Mm-hmm. He was a very passionate man. And when we worked together, we did some things together that were awesome and changed a lot of people's lives. And when you go rewind about 10, 15 years, we did one reunion show, like whatever, 10 years back or something like that. And I thought I was never going to play Vengeance ever again. We wound up doing this reunion show.
Really?
And the reunion show spawned another show. So we played in Switzerland. We did a show out there. And
I didn't know this.
We did that show. It was with Scott Waters singing on vocals. When we did that and we played, I kind of went out there going, oh, that's cool, you know, get to play out in Switzerland and this kind of thing and meet some fans out there. But it wasn't until that show that I realized the impact that Vengeance had in the long haul. Because mm-hmm. as Roger said, we were actually bigger in Europe than we were in U.S. Our mailing list was twice the size in Europe than it was in the U.S. markets. So our sales at that point on the first album, especially because that's where we had the Medusa distribution, the Capitol stuff.
Right.
It got to Europe, and people were eating it up, and they liked it. And when I went out there, I was meeting these guys who were, you know, 40 years old, and he goes, oh, my God, I'm a pastor of a church now. I was a drug addict in the streets, and, you know, people, and it's story after story of people, how he affected them and changed their lives, and now they're doing it. And it took me back because there was a point in my life where I really felt like, God, was this my ego doing this? Mm-hmm. Or did you actually have a purpose for me doing this? Like, was there something right. to it? You know, you start to question your actions and what you did. Was this valid or was this just me being a rock star, you know?
Right.
And but so many stories and so many people and so many things. And it kept coming and coming and coming. And these people were reaching out to me from all these different countries going, oh, yeah, this happened. This happened. And I left that show so humbled because I realized, you know, I'm so futile in my thoughts. And God knows this big picture out there.
Hmm.
And he doesn't bother explain everything to us because that's not his job. His job is to make these miracles happen through us and through other people. And we don't see the effects of it often, but I saw it there, and it took me back, and I go, you know, I'm honored and I'm privileged, and I realize, wow, God really used us in a mm-hmm. mighty way. And that's why when I look back now on what Martinez did, my God, Martinez planted so many seeds and did so much work and did so many great things that regardless of wherever he's at now, what he believes and what he thinks, his heart was in the right place and he changed lives. And God bless that guy. He did a lot of good. So.
Okay. Well said. Well spoken. Fair enough. Didn't answer my question.
So, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened to him.
Right.
And it would all be speculation. But whatever happened to him, it's, you know, we all deal with stuff in our life. And we have our tribulations and trials and crap, and he dealt it with the way he felt he had to, you know, so.
Right, sure enough.
But, yeah, I feel no ill will towards the guy, and I only wish him love and compassion, and I thank him for all the times we had together. You know?
Does anyone still talk to him?
Not that I know of, no.
There hasn't really been any communications with him?
No.
Well, I hope he hears this, then. I hope he hears that line anyway, but I don't know. I don't know if he ever will or not. I think he'd make for an amazing guest. What a roller coaster ride that would be, but oh well.
Well, yeah. He'd be an amazing interview.
I know. I know he would. So, moving forward, what's on the horizon here?
Well, this is kind of an awakening of sorts. For us, I mean, like we said, it's 30-year reunion for our show that we did for the release of our first album. And looking at the good that we were used for and the things that we were able to do through that album were amazing. And to me, I feel like the love I have for Roger and Larry is immense. We've been through a lot of stuff together in our lives. I like I said, I grew up with Larry since I was a kid. And mm-hmm. then once I got older and I met Roger, me and Roger, we lived together for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And we have a love and a bonding together. And I think if we all feel called to the same purpose, that there's something to it. And I haven't felt this feeling in a long time, this kind of awakening where I feel like, you know something? I think there is something there. And I think we could do it and capture the original essence of what we were shooting for. Hmm. And that's my wow. dream and my hope, that by doing this again, we could actually have that excitement and like Roger talked about, like Ted Nugent. It wasn't Ted Nugent. It was what he brought on stage and that excitement and the energy. And I want to bring that and give that energy to other people. And I hope we can do that through this whole thing, and we can make it work out really well. So,
wow.
I have high expectations for it, because I don't feel like it's just me and my ego now doing this. And Roger Martin's always been my checkmate on everything. He's been always able to tell me, Doug, if you know, if I'm going off the edge or not, you know. So I've always trusted his thought and his opinion, and if I feel like he's in on it and Larry's in on it, then I'm totally in on it too.
That's interesting. Is that something that you feel that you weren't keeping in check in some of the earlier Vengeance years? Like maybe a little bit of it was, or maybe a lot of bit of it, whatever the percentage would be, was a little bit too much Doug and not enough Vengeance, not enough.
No. Basically, what Doug's talking about, I was the spiritual watchdog of the group. Everybody had their roles. Doug was the brains. Larry was the talent, and I was the encourager. I kept people. And so when we all kept each other in check, basically.
Okay. Okay, and, I see.
Doug's excited about it, a lot of things. I didn't do the second Die Happy album because I wrote with the flow of where I think God wants me. And at that time, for the second album of Die Happy, I was playing in a group that was more of a southern rock group. We were working with a couple of motorcycle groups, Christ Motor Club and Bikers for Christ. We were playing prisons. We did biker runs, and that's what I was involved in right before the second album with Die Happy. And that just proves the theory that we weren't ditching Martinez to play Die Happy. That was just a project that came together. And for what's ahead in the future for me, I'm still that way. Where does God want me? What's going on? And I would say to Doug, what's the point of doing this? What are we doing this for? And so I always kind of kept it in that perspective, and I feel good about this new project, Travis.
Mm-hmm.
I've been deep down. There's been an excitement for bands for me. And I don't know where it is. I've looked around here. I've looked in different places. And guess what? I found it. It's this project that we're doing right now.
Man, that's exciting. That's cool. I think we can I think we can bring this thing in for a landing now. I really appreciate your time. Thanks, guys, for coming on. Jim, I haven't heard from you in a while. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
I assume you were, because I heard a motorcycle go by.
No, you know what? I've had this on mute, so because I didn't want you guys to yell at me anymore. So now I know that it's somebody else.
Well, in Doug and Roger's defense, they weren't yelling at you. It was all me. I know.
Yeah. I know.
All right.
It's all good.
I stand in the light of this.
And clear.
As the Story Grows is a part of Lavera Productions.
High five. Follow me on Twitter and Facebook at As the Story Grows and visit the site at asthestorygrows.com. Make sure to subscribe to the show so you don't miss anything. Visit the Bandcamp link in the notes of this show for free cover songs, some free tunes, and merch. If you like what you heard and would like to help, there's a Patreon link on every episode, or you can look for the dollar sign on the website for one-time donations. If you can't afford to donate, that's totally okay. Tell a friend, retweet me, and give me a good rating on iTunes. Send your guest requests and any feedback for the show to asthestorygrows@gmail.com, and thank you so much for listening today.
Love you. Take care. Bye-bye.